This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump imposed what he described as hard-hitting new financial sanctions on Iran Monday, specifically targeting the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Mr. Trump signed the executive order he said would curb access that Khamenei and the country have to world financial markets. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said the action would literally lock up tens of billions of dollars of Iranian assets. Meanwhile, the United States and Iran exchanged accusations at the United Nations. AP correspondent Mike Rossio.
At a United Nations Security Council meeting Monday, the United States laid blame on Iran for recent attacks on two oil tankers in the Persian Gulf.
It's clear to us, and it should be to the world, that Iran was responsible for the May 12th and June 13th attacks against ships in the Persian Gulf.
Speaking with reporters afterwards, acting U.S. UN Ambassador Jonathan Cohen also said last week's shootdown of a U.S. drone was over international, not Iranian waters. But Iranian UN Ambassador Majid Takhravanshi called the Security Council meeting a sham.
We expressed our readiness and requested to participate in that meeting. However, unfortunately, we were denied.
I'm Mike Rossia.
President Trump signed an executive order Monday, which he calls a groundbreaking action that will increase the quality, affordability, and fairness in the U.S. healthcare system. The order would require hospitals to disclose prices up front, showing what patients can expect to pay for services in a manner Trump says will be clear, straightforward, and accessible. This also means patients must be told at the beginning how much they can expect to pay out of pocket for deductibles and copays. U.S. President Trump says the letter he sent to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was very friendly in response to a letter he received from Kim earlier this month, wishing him a happy birthday. Trump told reporters at the White House Monday that Kim actually sent him birthday wishes and it was a friendly letter. Trump turned 73 June 14th. This is VOA News. Deaths have occurred along the border with Mexico. AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
Two babies, a toddler and a young woman in their 20s, were found dead together Sunday in Texas, not far from the Rio Grande. A law enforcement official says they may have been overcome by the scorching heat after crossing the river. Last year, there were 283 border deaths. This year, there have been a number of deaths, including three children and an adult, likely drowning after their raft overturned. A six-year-old boy from India dying in the triple-digit heat in Arizona, and seven people drowning this month in the border canals near El Paso. A Border Patrol spokesman says the agents normally stationed near those canals are on other duties because of the migrant onslaught. I'm Tim McGuire.
Senior U.S. officials say they are already busy buttressing the nation's defenses against foreign interference for the 2020 presidential election. Only they admit the public may be kept in the dark about attacks and intrusions. Intelligence and election security officials have warned repeatedly that Russia, among other state and non-state factors, remains intent on disrupting the upcoming elections and that the Kremlin may even have gone easy on the U.S. during the 2016 midterm election, seeing the ability to impact the 2020 presidential race as the bigger prize. Clashes erupted in southern West Bank between Israeli security services and Palestinians Monday against the upcoming Peace to Prosperity workshop in Bahrain. The $50 billion U.S. economic plan published on Saturday calls for massive infrastructure projects and job creation for Palestinians. The plan does not address the core issues of the conflict between Israel and Palestine. One Palestinian protester,
"Let us alone! Let us in peace! We meet our..."
Neither Israel nor the Palestinians will have official representation at the two-day summit. The U.S. delegation is to be led by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports the White House counsel is refusing to allow presidential adviser Kellyanne Conway to appear before a House committee investigating allegations that she was involved in prohibited political activity.
The House refusal to allow Kellyanne Conway to answer questions from the House Oversight Committee, saying she's immune from the congressional testimonial process, sets the stage for a possible subpoena fight. The panel's chairman says he'll call for a vote if Conway fails to appear Wednesday. Conway's dismissed reports of possible Hatch Act violations, saying critics want to put a big roll of masking tape over her mouth because she helped get the president elected.
AP's Jackie Quinn. And finally, the 2026 Winter Game, the announcement there is that it'll be held in Milan, Italy. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, June the 25th, and here's some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. Ethiopia marked a national day of mourning on Monday after four high-ranking government officials, including the chief of the army, were assassinated over the weekend. State media reported that the alleged mastermind of Saturday's coup attempt in Ethiopia's northern Amhara state, General Asminaw Tige, was shot and killed while trying to escape from security forces. And in what many say was a surprise move, Zimbabwe's central bank announced that it banned the use of multiple currencies as it tries to rein in inflation in the country.
There was no prior notification by the government to indicate that it was going to ban the so-called basket of currencies that Zimbabwe had been using since 2009.
That is Blessing Zulu. He's a reporter with VOA Studio 7. And Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, warns that the government plans to use a measure under consideration in parliament to blacklist opponents as well as critics. And in Nigeria, President Muhammadu Buhari says that his administration is implementing new security measures to combat banditry and violence carried out by militants against unarmed civilians.
The army is reporting that the villagers who have abandoned their homes and their farms are gradually returning because peace has been restored.
That's Nigeria's presidential spokesman, Garba Shehu. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And we'll start in Ethiopia, where the country marked a national day of mourning on Monday after four government officials, including the governor of the Amhara region and the chief of the army, were assassinated over the weekend in what government says were coordinated attacks in the nation's capital, Addis Ababa, and Amhara state capital of Bahirda. State media reported that the alleged mastermind of Saturday's coup attempt in Ethiopia's northern Amhara state, General Asminaw Tige, was shot and killed on Monday while trying to escape from security forces. Gunmen broke into a meeting in Bahirda on Saturday, killing regional president Ambachew Mekonnen and one of his senior advisors. Hours later, Ethiopia's army chief of staff was killed by his bodyguard at his home in Addis Ababa. Officials say that the two attacks were linked. Internet continues to be shut down in much of the nation as the country comes to grips with Saturday's incidents. In Zimbabwe, the central bank has announced that it banned the use of multiple currencies as it tries to rein in inflation in the country. The announcement said that forthwith, the US dollar, South African rand, and other foreign currencies will no longer be recognized as legal tender in Zimbabwe. The directive said that the country's sole legal tender was its interim currency, the RTGS dollar, a move that ends a decade of dollarization aimed at relaunching the Zimbabwean dollar. In a related move, the central bank hiked its overnight lending rate to 50% from 15% as part of a set of measures to protect the RTGS dollar introduced in February of this year. The news in Zimbabwe was received with skepticism, many questioning what they see as a move intended to be a quick fix for the deep troubles that have constrained economic growth in the country. As my colleague Zimbabwe reporter Blessing Zulu tells me, this all came as a surprise to many, especially those in the business community.
This was a surprise move, and there was no prior notification by the government to indicate that it was going to ban the so-called basket of currencies that Zimbabwe had been using since 2009. So because the Zimbabwe dollar was not performing well, there was hyperinflation from around 2004-2005, the government was forced to abandon the Zim dollar because prices were going like three times a day. And the Zimbabweans needed billions of dollars, sometimes trillions
yes,
of dollars.
To go buy bread.
Exactly.
I remember pictures of people wheeling around, you know, wheelbarrows
yes.
to go buy a loaf of bread.
Yes.
So what is the inflation rate like in the country right now?
Currently,
Zimbabwe?
It's nearly 100%. Mm-hmm. These are the latest figures from the Zimbabwe National Statistics Agency issued sometime last week.
What has been the reception so far on this announcement in Zimbabwe? How has the business community responded to it?
I think the majority of people that we talked to, including economists, members of the opposition, and even some government officials, were actually taken aback by this development, because really nobody knows what is going to happen. And all the countries in the world that have dollarized, no country has successfully de-dollarized. In Zimbabwe, if this is successful, this will be actually a first
in
the world.
A radical economic move.
Indeed. But the fear from the business community and most economists is that what this means is that the government will just be able to print money. You know, the economy was a bit stable because the government was not able to print US dollars. But now, if it is given the key to the printing machine, where Zimbabwe will slide back to the years of before 2008. So, and there are fears that it's going to be another hyperinflationary environment.
What happens if you're a Zimbabwean and you're traveling to, say, South Africa to go visit family or to do shopping? What happens to the monies? Are you able to purchase goods with the Zim dollar, the RTGS?
What they are proposing is that if you have a foreign currency account or an FCA, you are still able to maintain that account with your US dollars.
Now, so if you want to travel,
yes, because the situation in Zimbabwe is very complicated in that most of the US dollars are sold on the streets, the so-called black market.
Yes.
And then the government tried to push people to trade it through the banks. It has not been successful. So you have an interbank rate, which is 1:6. You know, one US dollar, six RTGSs.
Right.
But if you go on the black market, the parallel market, which is thriving, it's 1:14 today. So that's
1:14.
Yes, that's the difference. Mm. So what they are trying to do is to push people to use the formal, the formal channels of accessing foreign currency. But many are agreed that this will not work.
Is there an upside to this economic strategy, say, for example, for people in rural areas or the local person who did not have access to dollars?
Basically, for the majority of Zimbabweans, this policy is not going to change anything, because the government, what is it is simply saying is that you cannot sell your goods in US dollars. So what the business people are simply doing is to multiply by 14 using the parallel market rate, and then they sell you that same
goods at 40 times the value.
Exactly. So it's not like, because for some time the government was saying it was 1:1. You know, so they were actually forcing people to say you trade one RTGS dollars to one US dollar. It worked for some time, but eventually, you know, the parallel market started thriving.
Yes.
So they are trying to undercut that. And of course, they are promising to arrest people. And interestingly, even the ruling ZANU-PF party's youth today were saying that there are some senior government officials linked to President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who are promoting this thriving black market. So they were naming and shaming them. So what it means is that it's clear that all is not well in Zimbabwe. The wheels are off to 2008.
How do you explain this type of decision-making, especially coming from the Minister of Finance, Mthuli Ncube, very well-respected economist? Mm-hmm. What do you think happened? Some of the forces behind that.
The problem is when Professor Mthuli Ncube was hired as an outsider or as a technocrat, I think what he was saying is exactly the opposite of what he is implementing right now. Because he said before he was hired, when many people were speculating that he was going to be hired, he said that he is going to do away with the RTGS dollars because they were causing problems. The government was printing a lot of money. And this was, and the International Monetary Fund as well was complaining that these are quasi-fiscal operations that are actually affecting the economy. So when he came in, many economists had actually predicted that he was not going to be his own man, you know. So he comes in. There are some people, because what the ruling ZANU-PF party in Zimbabwe is trying to do is to try and imitate what is happening in China, where the Communist Party has a say in how you run the economy. Mm. But unfortunately, for Zimbabwe, there's a lot of corruption. In China, you know what happens if you are
arrested, you are detained
or you are even killed. Mm. But sadly for Zimbabwe, that is not what is happening. So there is another think tank of former government ministers at the ZANU-PF headquarters, the so-called Shake Shake House in Harare, that are directing government
economic policy.
So Mthuli might be a technocrat, but he is not being allowed to implement his Harvard economics. Mm.
So basically the political forces and the circumstances under which he's operating are much larger than his influence.
Indeed.
And Blessing, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
Yeah. Blessing Zulu is a Zimbabwean reporter with Voice of America Studio 7. Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, warns that the government plans to use a measure under consideration in parliament to blacklist opponents as well as critics, including non-government organizations. The party says that a new measure called a special bill supplement could contravene the constitution, which guarantees freedom of speech. If passed into law, the measure will enable the government to institute a fine against foreigners who fail to seek permission before filming in the country. Additionally, the raw video footage would have to be submitted to the Tanzania Film Board as well as acquire a clearance form before leaving the country. But opposition and civil rights groups have condemned the move, saying parliamentarians would not have enough time to debate the measure. Chadema says that it would seek a legal challenge in court if President John Magufuli signs the measure into law. And for more about the opposition party's concerns, VOA's Peter Claudio reached John Malia, head of legal affairs for Chadema.
This bill is brought under statute of urgency. It means the parliament won't be given enough time to discuss. The stakeholders who are touched by this bill, when it comes to law, they won't be given time to give their opinion. And under normal circumstances, you don't use statute of urgency in normal laws. But again, the content of the law intends to register non-government organizations which are registered as a company tax. And truly they are aiming at these vocal non-government organizations, vocal NGOs that have been critical to the government. So people are not happy about it. Our party is not happy about the process. So it's quite important that the party are going to, our member of parliament are going to vote against this bill. But again, the ruling party has a majority in the parliament. So we don't think we can at least succeed in stopping in the parliament.
Some people are suggesting that the main opposition party, Chadema, your party, should go to court to seek redress to prevent this from happening. But others are saying that perhaps you should organize a series of demonstrations to register your protest. What is the stance of your party?
Okay, we have attempted to go to court some other time to stop a bill, but we couldn't make it. In Tanzania, it's a bit hard to stop a bill. Can go to challenge a law when it's already passed. But when it's a bill, you cannot succeed that very much. So what we're thinking is that there's a law passed. See what the parliamentarians will create. And when that law has come into existence, now we can think of a way of dealing with it. If it's going to court, local court in Tanzania, or if it's a community court, we'll look at it and see what we can do about it.
That was John Malia, the head of legal affairs for Tanzania's opposition party, Chadema. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti. This is Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. And from Tanzania, we go to Nigeria, where President Muhammadu Buhari says that his administration is implementing new security measures to combat banditry and violence carried out by militants against unarmed civilians. The announcement follows events in Zamfara State, where alleged bandits killed several people. Civil society, human rights, and opposition groups have expressed concern over growing insecurity in parts of the country, where there has been a sharp increase in kidnappings. Critics of the government say that the president has failed in his core mandate to protect life and property of citizens. They have called on the president to fire all security service chiefs for incompetence. And for more on this situation, VOA's Peter Claudio reached Garba Shehu,
presidential spokesman in the capital, Abuja.
There is an ongoing operation by all of the security services and agencies under the government of Nigeria. And the army, the air force, the police, the secret services, everyone is there, and there's a hands-on operation going on. And the tide has turned now. As we speak to you, you know that Katsina State, which also had witnessed a spiral of these attacks, has largely been calmed down. As a matter of fact, as I speak to you, all the camps housing internally displaced persons have been closed, but just one. And even in Zamfara State, which is the epicenter of these acts of banditry, the army is reporting that the villagers who had abandoned their homes and their farms are gradually returning because peace has been reinstated. So yes, they are on their back foot now, and they're being chased out of the Nigerian territorial space. So victory is on site.
Critics of the government are saying that the attack in Zamfara State is an indication that there has been increase in banditry and attacks on innocent civilians despite assurances by the president and his administration. How do you react to that?
There was an infiltration by bandits into Zamfara State a week ago. Whoever is a witness to the height of things, when these things were really ratcheting up the entire state, we do know that there has been a substantial decline, and as I said, these things are being pushed back and being defeated. So yes, we had an incident in Zamfara last week, but in between then and now, or before that time, there had been a calm down. So therefore, it is wrong to say that there is an increase. Yes, there was an infiltration, and the president has charged the security agencies to act with promptness and speed to ensure that these infiltrations don't anymore occur.
Some opposition supporters are saying that the president should fire all the service chiefs and replace them with competent people because they have failed him, because he has promised Nigerians that he will protect life and property as mandated under the constitution, but that these service chiefs have failed to take the orders of the president to ensure they are safe, and that you have seen kidnappings, including a setback in the fight against Boko Haram and terrorist groups. How do you respond to this?
The president has confidence in the leaders of the security services and agencies. That is why he's retaining them. These men and women in uniform are working day and night to make life safe for Nigerians. There have been breaches. There have been an upscale of banditry and kidnapping and infiltration by ISIS into our own country. But all of these things are being pushed back. And I think that what the army, the police, and our security services, they need the support of Nigerians. The Nigerians cannot be fighting their army at the same time when the ISIS and the bandits are also fighting them. They need the support, they need information from every citizen so that they can know about the movements and the plans of these bandits so that they go after them. The president decides who he retains as army chief, as police head, and all of that. If he's satisfied with the work that they're doing, it's not for opposition to say that he should fire them. He retains their confidence, and that's why he's keeping them.
How is the government trying to encourage citizens to provide the security agencies with information or intelligence in the fight against Boko Haram and some of these bandits?
Well, by giving assurances to whistleblowers that they will be protected, there will be no exposure of their own identity when they give such information. But more than any other thing, it's a call to patriotic duty, because every citizen has a duty to support law enforcement in this country. So it's not for people to sit back and do nothing from their homes and just be pointing and accusing fingers at President Muhammadu Buhari, who sits in Abuja here. It's for Buhari, all right, but it's also a matter for all Nigerians. At the moment, we don't realize that it is our own business, and security is not the business of everyone. Then things will begin to fall apart.
That was Garba Shehu, Nigeria's presidential spokesman. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. The Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance and Tanzanian activists have expressed concerns on the growing threat of climate change to regional development. This comes as more than 70% of natural disasters in the region are said to be climate-related. Moses Havyarimana has more on this from Arusha.
Despite the East African heads of state directing the Secretariat to develop climate change policy and strategies to address the adverse impacts of climate change in the region, more than 70% of the natural disasters in the region are climate-related. Rebecca Muna is the executive director of Tanzanian Association of Civil Society Organizations committed to work on climate change.
Africa have pledged and we are willing to go clean, but we said we'll go green, we use this renewable energy only and only if you will give us technology, only if you will give us finance, all those means of implementation and the capacity part of it.
According to the Carbon Emission Report, North America is home to 5% of the world's pollution but emits 18% of the carbon dioxide. Asia with 60% of the population and emits almost 18%, while Africa has 16% of the population and emits 4%. The inequality in global emissions has been the major concern of why international agreements on climate change has been contentious. Charles Mwangi is the thematic leader of the African Climate Justice Alliance.
You know, we are meeting race, but we are suffering most. What is the connection? You know, if I have a house that have 5 rooms and I have 5 sons in each of those particular rooms, now taking those rooms to be the continents we have in the globe, if one of them is a smoker, are we going to feel or experience that particular smell in the rest of us? We are, even though we're in the other rooms.
Matthias Kasamba is a member of the parliament from Uganda.
It is not about refusing us to use coal. They used coal because that was the knowledge base by then. How do we empower ourselves to use clean energy, solar energy, alternative energy systems to be introduced, like solar energy? In Tanzania, we are still charging taxes on solar energy.
However, Tanzanian lawmaker Habib Munya believes that stopping coal mining in countries without available options will negatively impact the development of the country.
If we have coal in Tanzania, if they have coal in Kenya, is now a problem to use coal to build a power station? You cannot develop if you don't have enough energy. They are stopping us not to develop. We have gases here. All our East African countries, we are still importing gases for cooking.
Tanzania is expected to cut its carbon emissions by 30% in 2025, while Kenya projected to cut its emissions by 2030. However, poverty and lack of alternative sources of energy still remains a major challenge for developing countries to abide by the Paris Agreement and reducing the carbon emissions. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
And that's it for this Tuesday, June the 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clodi, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.